Good morning. It is Monday, January 27th, 2020, and this is Ozarks at Large on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. We are again an hour earlier than usual today as we shift a bit of our daytime lineup at KUAF for NPR's live coverage of the impeachment trial in the United States Senate. Today's coverage is scheduled to begin in just under an hour at noon. Ahead this hour, Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep talks to us about his new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. He talked to us by phone Friday morning. All of the news about the impeachment trial and all of the news from around the country and from around the world will be ready for you tomorrow morning on 91.3 KUAF on Morning Edition. Each weekday from 5 to 9, Morning Edition helps us understand what's happening in the environment, in politics, and in culture. And we also bring you news and information from our part of the world each weekday morning with Antoinette Grajeda's newscast at 5:30 and 7:30 and the Community Spotlight with Pete Hartman each Monday through Friday at 6:30 and 8:30 a.m. And if you've ever experienced a flat tire while bicycling, you know the frustrations. You might not just be stuck, but stuck with something you have to carry. Tomorrow and for the next three Tuesdays after tomorrow, there is a clinic for how to fix a flat, covering everything from removing the wheel to knowing just which tools to take with you in case of a flat. The clinic is at Play Try Rogers on South 1st Street in Rogers, beginning tomorrow evening at 5:30. You can learn more at playtryrogers.com. This is Ozarks at Large. Insulin prices are on the rise across the country. A new study finds the average cost more than doubled over 5 years in Arkansas, where health officials say nearly 288,880 adults had a known diagnosis of diabetes in 2014. An estimated 75,000 adults had the disease but didn't know it. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
Analysis by the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement, a nonpartisan independent health policy center, finds the average cost of an insulin prescription rose from $401 in 2013 to $617 in 2018. Dr. Joe Thompson, president and CEO of the center, says he was shocked by the 54% increase.
The pharmaceutical industry argues that their drug costs go up because of the development of new drugs or because they're developing drugs for people with rare conditions. This is a drug that's been around for decades for conditions that we've known about for even longer. So this is not a new drug. This is not a new condition. And we were very surprised that it went up over 50% in just 5 years.
Thompson says one of the frustrations with the price increase is the absence of a clear explanation for charging more.
It's not clear that when the drug is made at the pharmacy or pharmaceutical company and sold to the pharmacy benefit manager and then supplied to the local pharmacy where you and I get our drugs, where is this 54% increase going? The legislature has passed legislation to open up that black box of the pharmacy benefit managers. But really, this is something that Congress is going to have to force out into the open so that we better understand when and why our drug prices are going up so much.
Arkansas legislators have taken a step in that direction with the Arkansas Healthcare Transparency Initiative Act of 2015, which supports the development of an Arkansas all-payer claims database. ACHI used insurance claims information within the initiative to determine the annual cost of insulin. For the purpose of this analysis, the average cost includes the amount paid by the insurer, plus the patient's out-of-pocket cost, which varies based on the insurance plan. If prices continue to rise, Thompson says it could impact Arkansans with tight budgets.
People that are diabetic, and particularly type 1 diabetics that are dependent upon insulin to stay alive, some type 2 diabetics also have to have insulin to maintain their glucose levels. They're going to directly feel this when they go to fill their prescription at the pharmacist. That's going to be a direct effect. An indirect effect that will come downstream is when their health insurance premiums go up. Those individuals now that are starting the new year with a high deductible are probably paying more out of pocket and thus having to make a decision of what they're not going to be able to pay for, particularly our older Arkansans that are on fixed incomes.
Kate Oxford has type 1 diabetes and says the cost of her insulin and other supplies factor into her family's budget.
And sometimes, just depending on the month or what's going on in our lives, there are months that I can only get 1 month of supplies because it's just outrageously expensive. And so it's hard being a diabetic and knowing that you need these supplies, but also being a parent and a wife and a homeowner and all of these things and trying to decide what's more important to buy this month.
Oxford pays about $30 a month for 4 bottles of insulin. While she hasn't noticed an increase in the cost of her insulin, she has experienced an increase in the cost of her other supplies, like her insulin pump and her glucose monitor, over the last 5 years or so.
So it would start out at, like, you know, $60, and now I'm up to, for 1 month of my pump supplies, it's $150. So it slowly increases, which blows my mind that insulin and diabetes supplies, the cost is just going through the roof, because people who are not affected by this disease or know somebody and understand it don't realize that this little vial of clear liquid literally keeps me alive. It is something that I cannot go a day without because my pancreas has failed.
Type 1 diabetes is a chronic condition in which the pancreas produces little or no insulin and there is no cure. Oxford, who's now 29, was barely 6 years old when she was diagnosed.
I feel that I am lucky in the aspect that I was so young, because I don't remember what life is like without being diabetic. But it is a very difficult disease to have because it doesn't go away. It's always there. I never get a break. And so, and now that I'm pregnant with my second child, life with diabetes is even harder.
Pregnancy complicates Oxford's condition because it creates insulin resistance,
which I'm currently facing right now, and it sucks. It's horrible. So I'm having to take more insulin to keep my blood sugars at a lower rate because the baby inside of me is taking it as well. And so, like, when my first child, Mackenzie, was born, she actually had a low blood sugar. And she had a low blood sugar for probably 3 days. And it was just because my body was taking so much of the insulin that I was putting in it and going towards her, that her pancreas was overproducing by the time she was born.
Right now, Oxford has to change her pump site more often because she's using more insulin. She says going through pump supplies more quickly is difficult. However, she hasn't had to ask her doctor for extra insulin because she's been able to create a stockpile. Having extra insulin can help with budgeting if there's ever a month where her family needs to cut costs.
With getting 4 bottles of insulin, I'm usually able to carry over a bottle each month. So it kind of builds up as time goes on. So if I am not low on my supplies in terms of my insulin, I'll kind of skip that. And I know it's only $30, but sometimes $30 is a tank of gas. And then there are other months that I will try and rewear my pump sights. You're only supposed to wear them 3 days, but there are times that I'll wear them 6 days because it's just stretching that dollar a little bit more.
Kate Oxford belongs to Facebook groups for type 1 diabetics and says she's seen stories of people traveling to Canada or Mexico for cheaper supplies. She's also heard of people rationing their supplies and worries what life with diabetes might look like for her child.
You know, the thing that is terrifying is there is a chance that my child will have diabetes. I mean, clearly my dad's diabetic and I am, so there's a chance. And I pray that that doesn't happen, but if it does, I don't ever want her to face that. And so you read these stories of parents watching their children slowly losing their lives, and there's only so much you can do because it is costing so much money, and people just do not have it anymore.
Oxford says there needs to be a cap on prices so diabetics can afford the supplies they need.
In my opinion, insulin should be free. It really should, because I survive on this bottle of insulin. And so, yes, I understand that prescription companies need these to keep paying their employees. I understand that. But at the same time, they need to understand that there are those of us that can't afford it. And so if we could put, you know, $30 per bottle or something that is just affordable to anybody that's working a minimum wage job, or somebody that is able to not even have a job that's on Medicaid. It just needs to go, it needs to have some type of accommodation for everybody. And so, you know, I don't know the answer, but I just think that there needs to be a cap for everybody. And I think that the lower the cost, the better.
Last May, Colorado became the first state to cap insulin co-pays at $100 for insured residents. In November, Illinois also passed a bill that caps costs for some residents, but it doesn't go into effect until 2021. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And just ahead on today's show, our conversation with Steve Inskeep, one of the hosts of Morning Edition. He's written a new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. And he'll explain why Jesse and John Fremont were such celebrities in the middle of the 19th century. And stay with 91.3 KUIF today as we continue our live coverage of the impeachment trial in the United States Senate. That begins at noon today and will carry NPR's coverage until its conclusion this afternoon or this evening. This is Ozarks at Large. In the middle of the 19th century, John Fremont was about as famous as an American could be, and his wife Jessie was too. Fremont ventured west, cataloging the landscape between St. Louis and Oregon. His work dovetailed with the call for manifest destiny and the costs that could be associated with such a westward expansion, including violence and bigotry. The Fremont's spectacular notoriety may not have endured into 2020, but Steve Inskeep's new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War, reminds us of just how large the couple's influence was in the mid-19th century. Inskeep, a host of NPR's Morning Edition, talked to us Friday morning about his new book. Our conversation began by acknowledging that 150 years after John Fremont's travels west first captured a nation's attention, his name is not nearly as familiar as other figures from the time.
I think you're exactly right, and even if you read history, you will read about him. He's in thousands of books, but usually briefly mentioned in books about the Civil War or the Old West, westward expansion, that sort of thing. He's in thousands of books, described as super famous and super ambitious, and sometimes his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont, also appears in these narratives. But maybe you don't get a very vivid or deep explanation of why he was so famous. This is a story of a supremely famous and ambitious American couple who invented a very American kind of celebrity and also did really substantive things. They were central characters in what was called Manifest Destiny, a westward expansion. John Charles Fremont was a U.S. Army officer who was exploring the American West. His job was to go out there and map things like the Oregon Trail. Later, he went into Mexican-controlled California and began or was involved in the process of taking it over by the United States. So he's out there doing real things, but his true mission, at the beginning especially, was not to discover anything particularly new, which he didn't. In fact, he got sensitive about that as time went on. His job was to publicize through his maps, and also by going back east and writing these amazing lyrical accounts of his adventures in the West, which were meant to entice Americans to settle the West as a way of taking it over. This was the vision of his father-in-law, this very powerful U.S. Senator, Thomas Hart Benton, who had been a newspaper man himself at one time and knew all about publicity. And through his vision, John C. Fremont told the story of going out west in a way that his accounts could be excerpted in newspapers, they could be printed as popular books, and they were, which became kinds of guidebooks for people loading up their covered wagons and going along the Oregon Trail. And he wrote this story in a way that he was always at the center of it. As he was making the West more famous, he was making himself more famous.
You mentioned that he was sensitive about not finding something new, but he was meticulous in the map finding. He wouldn't put something on a map unless he had seen it himself, which was the norm.
No, it wasn't. There was a tendency at that time to, and understandably so, because the continent was so large and people had traveled all over it. But if you were an individual map maker, where would you find the people who would be reliable to tell you? And so you would put things on a map that you had heard, or some fur trapper would come into St. Louis and there'd be a guy adjusting and adding to a map there. And the fur trapper would say there was a mountain a certain number of days west of some other mountain. And how exactly do you measure those miles, you know? And there were rivers on maps that didn't even exist. They were just rumors of rivers, and they would get on maps. And Fremont, although he was an amateur, not formally trained as a cartographer, a map maker, had learned at the feet of a man named Nicolet, a Frenchman who had come and mapped the source of the Mississippi River, among other things. And having learned how to do this, yeah, if the map was blank, if there was an area of the map that was white space, he and his men would go across it, and they would leave most of that space blank. They would only map the trail that they themselves had covered and a little bit of the landscape to either side that they could see.
I guess he was an enemy of fake views.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's something that you think about as a journalist. You have to be careful to observe all that you can yourself, and where it's not possible to observe all that you can yourself, to double check and triple check and quadruple check your sourcing, and also make it clear to the listener or the reader what your source is.
As amazing as John Fremont's life was, Jesse, his wife, has, I would argue, an even more amazing life when you consider the options for women in the mid-19th century.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's an unusual story because, not just because she was influential, there were a lot of influential women in Washington quietly and behind the scenes, but because she was so open about it, she became so public in her involvement in politics. Jesse was the daughter of this powerful senator, Thomas Hart Benton. He already had one daughter when she was born, and he was expecting a son, and he had resolved to name the son after his father. He was disappointed to find out it was a girl, but also a stubborn guy, and so he named her after his father anyway, just a slight change of spelling, Jesse, J-E-S-S-I-E. And Jesse later wrote in a memoir, "My father early gave me the place a son would have had." When she was a little girl, she would follow him out hunting and carry the game bag in which there'd be a dead bird that he had just shot. She would follow him to the United States Senate when he had work to do. She would follow him even to the White House when he was visiting various presidents, starting with Andrew Jackson. She was richly and deeply involved in his career in the way that you would expect a son to be in this time of much more rigid gender roles. There came a time, though, when her father tired of this. As a teenager, she cut off her hair and said, "I just want to live life as your assistant." And he said, "No, it's time to grow back your hair and become a woman now. Men will not be attracted to a woman with short hair," he said, according to a memoir that Jesse wrote much later. And she did end up marrying, eloping actually, this young U.S. Army lieutenant, John Charles Fremont, who became the famous explorer. She was unable to be his assistant, so she married a man who was destined to assist him in his mission, his vision of settling the American West and capturing the Pacific coast and putting a seaport there where Americans could trade with Asia. In a way, she did become his assistant. As a grown-up, she sat in on his meetings. She helped him to translate documents. And she was also forever helping her husband as his secretary, as the editor of his brilliant writing, sometimes his co-writer or ghostwriter, also as his political advisor and representative when he was away from Washington.
And it's amazing what we're talking about, this manifest destiny. If someone gets on a plane today in St. Louis and flies to Portland, they complain about the long flight.
Yeah.
Going from St. Yeah. Louis to Oregon during this Oregon fever time is crazy.
Yeah, it's months and months, and Oregon fever is the right term. Partly because of John C. Fremont's writings, I believe, along with other reasons, people were very excited about the idea of going west, very excited about the idea of going to Oregon, even though it was a horrible, horrible experience. Now, Fremont's reports gave directions to do this safely just by showing how he had done it and suggested that the landscape was not quite as forbidding as some people feared it would be, but it was nevertheless an extremely dangerous trek. They would forever be fearful of Indians. Unnecessarily, I learned, when you read Fremont's accounts, he's actually being aided by Indians all the time, even though he is worried about Indian attacks, and sometimes there are fights, and sometimes they're started by Fremont. But they're worried about Indians, they're worried about the landscape, they're worried about the mountains. You have to worry about the winter, you have to worry about snow, and on some of his expeditions, Fremont's men became trapped in snowy mountains and had to fight their way out, and some of them did not make it.
In Perfect Union, how Jesse and John Fremont mapped the West, invented celebrity, and helped cause the Civil War. Finally, did that subtitle when you were writing it frighten you? Because that's a lot.
The subtitle came late in the process, and when I put the subtitle on it, I knew the material and believed in it. I knew that he had mapped the West and had promoted the West. I knew that they had invented, not they weren't the first famous people, but they had invented a new kind of celebrity, an American kind of celebrity, where you haven't achieved already some great position of eminence. You're not a famous president or a king or a victorious general. You're someone who is making yourself famous through the expanding news media at the very same time you're doing the things that are supposed to make you famous. He was promoting his exploits from even before the beginning of his first expedition. And there is something very, very modern about that. Helped cause the Civil War, yes, because ultimately he was so famous that he was a presidential nominee. He was the first ever nominee of the Republican Party, which was founded in the 1850s to oppose the expansion of slavery. And the rise of that party was seen as so threatening by Southern slave states that it led quite directly to the South seceding from the Union and firing the first shot ultimately in the Civil War. Fremont ran for president in 1856, lost, but followed the same political strategy essentially that Abraham Lincoln did when he won 4 years later.
Steve Inskeep, congratulations on the book. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Glad to do it.
Steve Inskeep is the author of the new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. He is also a host of Morning Edition on NPR. He talked with us Friday morning.
This is 60 Second Civics from the Center for Civic Education. I'm Mark Gage. In 1763, Britain won a long and costly war against France. The cost of the conflict left the British with a large national debt. Parliament saw the colonies as a source of much-needed money. They felt that the colonies should pay their portion of the cost of the war, since, among other reasons, the British Army had protected colonists on the western frontier from Native American tribes who were helping the French. To reduce the national debt, Parliament raised taxes in both Britain and the colonies. The British government also began to tighten trade regulations between the colonies and other nations. One example is the Proclamation of 1763, which banned settlement in certain western lands. Its purpose was to reduce tensions between the colonists and Native Americans. The British Army could then withdraw from the frontier and thus save the government money. The law was unpopular among American frontiersmen and traders. 60 Second Civics, where civic education only takes a minute.
The theme to 60 Second Civics is written and performed by Cheryl B. Englehart. You can find her online at cbemusic.com. That song is Complacent, which you can find on Apple Music, along with all of Cheryl's music. And ahead on this Monday Ozarks, more Americans are claiming their pets to be bona fide medical service animals to gain access to public places.
When I see dogs where they are relaxed in public, there's no panting, they're not looking around, they're not looking to interact with people other than their owner, that, to me, is a highly trained service dog.
We sort out service animal types and verification ahead on Ozarks at Large.
Walton Arts Center's 10x10 Art Series presents Apollo's Fire, Baroque Orchestra, Vivaldi's Four Seasons, Rediscovered, Saturday, February 29th at 8 p.m. This ensemble brings Vivaldi's beloved concertos to life as revolutionary acts of musical storytelling. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600. Thaden School is now accepting applications for students entering grades 6 through 12 during the 2020-21 academic year. Located in downtown Bentonville, Thaden educates students from across Northwest Arkansas. Applications and information at thadenschool.org.
A new Arkansas State Police headquarters and a regional crime lab laboratory are open in Lowell. Friday, officials hosted a dedication ceremony for the $14 million facility that sits on a 25-acre site along West Monroe Avenue. State Police Director Colonel Bill Bryant says the new facility will give the officers much-needed space.
For y'all who live up in Northwest Arkansas, you know the old Springdale headquarters was so small, if we held a troop meeting, we had to go to a school or another facility to actually hold a troop meeting. And also, we were not able to put all of our services under one roof. We actually had to rent facilities for our driver's license and Crimes Against Children Division. But what we tried to do, working with Governor Hutchison and our command staff, was to be able to strategically build this building where we could put all of our services under one roof.
The Lowell facility, the second largest police headquarters in the state, now houses Highway Patrol Troop L operations, all categories of driver license testing, Northwest Arkansas Criminal Investigation Division offices, and Crimes Against Children investigators. The building is also shared with the forensic scientists assigned to the Lowell Regional Crime Laboratory, which is part of the Arkansas State Crime Laboratory. Crime Lab Director Kermit Channel says 36% of the drugs and toxicology casework they receive come from Northwest Arkansas.
And to put this in a little bit of perspective, we get about 23,000 drug cases in a year. Okay, so already since we've opened the doors here, we've seen around 1,500 drug cases and a little over 200 toxicology cases. So it's a great opportunity. But one of the things I really want to emphasize is that it's great for Northwest Arkansas. Like the Colonel said, law enforcement officers can stay up here where they need to be policing in Northwest Arkansas. But what this really does, it helps the crime lab become more efficient for every county in Arkansas.
Because drug and toxicology evidence can be analyzed in the regional lab, officials say it will save hours of driving for officers and deputies who, until now, have had to make regular weekly trips to the state lab in Little Rock. Governor Asa Hutchinson says the responsibilities of officers are enormous, and there are two things they need.
They need to have the best equipment possible because their lives are at danger, at risk in what they do. They need to have the best equipment. Secondly, they need and deserve to have top quality facilities to work out of for these very difficult jobs. And to me, this is a wonderful facility to the Arkansas State Police that each one of those troopers and officers deserve and need. It will serve them well.
The Lowell location is the fourth new headquarters opened by Arkansas State Police. A fifth is scheduled to open in Newport in April. This is Ozarks at Large. Skilled service animals assist people with medical or psychological disabilities. Emotional support animals are trained to provide comfort. So how can you tell an animal is a bona fide provider? Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has more.
We often see them working in shops, restaurants, at schools, in public facilities, on buses and planes. Service dogs in special identification vests, tightly tethered to owners with disabilities.
These animals are pieces of medical equipment.
Shanti Stedham, a highly certified professional dog trainer, has operated NWA School for Dogs in Fayetteville since 2015.
I think it would be safe to say that there's two primary categories for dogs or service animals: physical or psychological, meaning that the physical dogs would be the ones who help keep people from falling over or retrieving things, opening and closing doors and things like that, where they assist in a physical capacity. Then the psychiatric dogs are the ones who are trained for people who might need deep pressure therapy or interrupting self-harming behaviors that they may be doing on themselves.
Over 500,000 service dogs, according to the nonprofit Share America, assist people with medical, psychological, visual, or hearing disabilities. Stedham says it can take up to 2 years to teach one dog the necessary skills.
A couple of years ago, I volunteered with an organization that was training PTSD service dogs for veterans. So they focused on PTSD and TBI, which is traumatic brain injury. And my primary capacity for their organization was to help evaluate rescue and shelter dogs, as well as train them in the foundation skills needed to pass the public access test.
Meaning the ability to remain on task in public.
In a manner where they ignore other people, they walk down the road and help their owner, they can go in and out of public environments, on and off of transportation like planes, trains, and automobiles, and they're kind of that unflappable dog.
Stedham says both Golden and Labrador Retrievers are the top service dog breeds.
So to me, when I see dogs at that high level of training where they are relaxed in public, there's no panting, they're not looking around, they're not looking to interact with people other than their owner, that to me is a highly trained service dog.
But the thing is, there is no official certification for service dogs, Stedham says.
There are no governing boards that certify service dogs. Each organization that trains your dog or trains the service dog would be the one to provide that certification.
More online vendors are selling service animal registration along with kits that include ID vests, collars, tags, and for owners, ID card for service dogs. ADA law does not require such paraphernalia, but businesses, public, and transportation facilities prefer such identification. And along with those legitimate vendors are those who sell fake registration and service dog regalia.
At this time, I don't believe there's any real way for the general public to verify if a dog is, in fact, a service dog. People put vests on their dog and they take their dog out in public. One way you can sort of gauge the dog is if they're appropriate in public, they're not being disruptive, they're not being unhygienic, like they're not having accidents, they're not barking or pulling their owner. They should be walking silently next to their owner, 100% attached to their owner.
Stedham says businesses and the public are barred under the Americans with Disabilities Act from challenging fake service dog owners.
And it's not our place to ask what somebody's disability is. It's our place to just stay out of their way and let the dog do their job.
Stedham says pets can be trained for disability service, but few can withstand the rigor.
Any dog can be trained to be a service dog. However, not all dogs have the temperament or physical requirements to be a service dog. They need to not only have the appropriate temperament to be fine in public, but they also have to be able to withstand the rigors of moving with you everywhere you go. They have to have healthy hips and joints and eyes.
For example, she brings out Dude, a massive rescue Newfoundland border collie mix.
And we don't really know how old he is. We're guessing he's around two.
Using tiny treats as incentives, Stedham signals to Dude to walk by her side, heel, lay down, and wait.
Service dogs spend a lot of time with their owners, and they basically, a lot of the time, sit around and wait for the next activity or movement from their owners. So we need a dog who's comfortable waiting and sitting in for long periods of time.
NWA School for Dogs is often queried about service dog training, which Stedham doesn't provide, but staff do teach force-free foundational skills to up to 15 dogs per day in individual and classroom settings.
That will take your dog through basic obedience all the way through the American Kennel Club's CGC, which is the Canine Good Citizen. They have also put together an advanced and urban Canine Good Citizen, which is essentially the public access test. And those opportunities to train with our organization will set your dog up to pass that public access test. And from there, we would get you set up with someone to help you train those mitigating tasks.
Bonafide service dogs must be accommodated under the Americans with Disabilities Act in housing, employment, and public facilities, but Stedham says the public needs to be trained to not interfere with any service animal.
The reason you should not interfere with a working dog is it would be the equivalent of trying to interrupt somebody's oxygen supply or moving their cane or walker. These dogs are highly trained and they need to be focused on their owner. If you were to distract them at any level, the dog may miss a very important cue, which they would then potentially be able to prevent injury or harm for their owner or handler.
And a growing number of credible agencies train and sell service dogs to suit certain disabilities.
Yes, they are not inexpensive. 2 years of training a dog to this level, you're looking at between $10,000 to $30,000.
Low-income Americans with disabilities may qualify for financial assistance from nonprofits and foundations, but that money is scarce. Christy Ferkgren is an advocate with Disability Rights Arkansas, a private nonprofit based in Little Rock, which advocates for more than 1,000 disabled Arkansans a year.
So there are various trainers across the state and surrounding states. So an individual that, you know, decides that they need a service animal for a specific disability can contact one of those places. They can also self-train.
Online courses are available for individuals who want to self-train service dogs, as well as for therapy dogs and emotional support dogs. Those animals are not task-trained, but are designed to provide comfort.
So ADA does not cover emotional support animals. The ADA only covers service animals. There are state laws that cover emotional support animals, the Fair Housing Act, covers emotional support animals. So if you are needing an emotional support animal, you can request an accommodation. If you're, you know, for your housing, you can request an accommodation to have an emotional support animal. They can request documentation. So you would need to provide a note from your doctor.
Last week, the U.S. Department of Transportation proposed excluding emotional support animals from commercial airlines to reduce the incidence of pets being claimed as service animals. In response to the draft restriction, the National Disability Rights Network issued a press release saying, if implemented, it will cause certain harm, and that federal regulation permits airlines to require documentation proving credible emotional support animal status. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And to learn more about service as well as emotional support animals, we have helpful links at ozarksatlarge.com.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today we're in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio with Carmen Nelson. She's with a group known as Animal League of Washington County. Carmen, very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you for having us.
When did this start and what's y'all's main focus?
You bet. So we were founded in 2011 with a group of people that I wanted to help the new Washington County Animal Shelter because that was in the planning stages at that point. We formed the Animal League as kind of a financial nonprofit arm for the shelter for different programs. So initially we were founded to help the shelter and the animals at the shelter, at the new shelter. We paid for all the fencing outside, the outdoor kennel runs. We wrote grants for all the clinic equipment, okay, things like that. So things just to help them get going and get started. But today we have several programs that help all of animals in Northwest Arkansas, where we pull animals from different shelters. We have our medical rehab program and our rescue transport program. And those are probably our two main programs that we do that will help people.
Do you have a main site, main building?
No, we home office. We're very frugal.
Now, I know y'all have actually a couple of events coming up in the relatively near future. One of them is kind of built around the Super Bowl, isn't it?
Well, yes, we're going to have a puppy bowl watch party. So if any of y'all have ever seen the Animal Planet, they do a puppy bowl the day of the Super Bowl. And so that will run from 2 to 4, okay, on Sunday, February 2nd. And it's just a watch party. Just come out, have some appetizers, some drinks. Bring your dog or dogs. We're going to be at Stone Chapel.
Nice. Super Bowl Sunday. Yeah, the puppy bowl. Head out there. Again, that's Stone Chapel in Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. And then in May, another event.
Yes. Yeah, so in May, we'll have our annual jog with the dog, and that will be at Lake Fayetteville. We meet down at the marina. We'll have all of our booths set up down there, and we serve breakfast, and we'll have a 5K and a 1 mile fun run walk. And again, of course, pet friendly, bring your animals.
People want to know more, who knows, maybe become a member, see if they can maybe help you voluntarily with volunteers. What's the best way to learn more?
They can go to our website, which is animalleagueofwashingtoncounty.org.
Okay. Facebook page, I'm guessing?
Yes, as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, awesome. Carmen Nelson with Animal League of Washington County. Carmen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The Community Spotlight on KUAF. Local matters.
It's Monday, January 27th, 2020. With me is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
I hope you saved me a big chunk of time because I want to talk about the Theater Squared play. And Laura Hightower wrote the story, so it was super long.
Okay, well, it's an intriguing concept, right? It's about Jack Johnson, the heavyweight champ, and it's staged like boxing rounds.
Right. It's called The Royale, and it's based on the life of Jack Johnson, who was the first African-American world heavyweight boxing champion. Mm-hmm. But it's not a direct lift of his life. The character is named Jay Jackson and is fictional. But
Inspired by,
and still a real chance to talk about race and privilege and
fame,
America's version of apartheid, mm-hmm, and a lot of heavy things. I thought we had a heavy enough day yesterday talking about death row.
Right.
But I don't think it's going to be, I don't think you'll walk out of it beaten up, so to speak. I think you'll walk out of it with a lot of things to think about and talk about. And it's the script writer, if you want a thought, the playwright's name is Marco Ramirez, and he's written for TV shows like Sons of Anarchy. So it's going to be heavy, but I think it'll be fascinating. and I can't wait to see it. The actor, Sean Middlebrooks, who plays the lead, says, I also think it's a beautiful story. The thing that really draws me to it is this. Men who are big and have a strong nature, you might pass them in the street and make an assumption about them, but you don't understand all of the inner workings of what's going on inside him, that he's multi-layered, that he's vulnerable, that he does have a heart. This is a beautiful piece that captures and shows all of the different colors that you might not see.
And it's in the main theater?
Yes, I think so. It'd be too big to be in the other
one.
And it will continue through February 16th. Showtimes are 7:30 Wednesday through Saturday, and then there's 2 o'clock matinees on Saturday and Sunday. Tickets start at $10 for their student prices and go up to $55. And you can get a hold of Theater Squared at 777-7477. I like their new phone number. Also this week on Thursday night, there's a thing going on at the Walton Arts Center that I think is going to be cool and hilarious. If you've still got your What's Up from yesterday, go read the Q&A with the musicians that make up Piano Battle.
These are two fellows who will sit both at their own piano and then they kind of battle off and play different things?
Yeah, it's sort of a little bit like a piano bar in New Orleans or somewhere, except they choose the music. Mm-hmm. And even doing an interview, they immediately dive into being competitive. Oh, no, I'm the greatest player of, like, Rachmaninoff. Well, fine, good for you, but I'm the greatest player of Chopin. It's hilarious. And an interesting experience, something you've probably never done before. 7 o'clock Thursday at the Walton Arts Center. This is part of their 10 by 10 series, so it's $10. How can you pass that? Coming up Saturday, Sona is doing Carmina Burana. How can you miss out on that? Bunch of guest performers, including the University of Arkansas Children's Choir. That'll be fun. And they're doing, I think, the Northwest Arkansas debut. I think it's been played other places, of a Paul Haas original piece called Angelique.
Oh, okay, yes.
So this all happens at 7:30 Saturday at the Walton Arts Center. Tickets start at $33, and prior to the performance, if you're a ticket holder, there's a creative conversation with Paul Haas and the guest artist before at 6:30. I hate to do this to you. Also, on Thursday night.
Right.
The Faulkner Performing Arts Center on the UA campus in Fayetteville is hosting a performance called Josephine. This is about Josephine Baker.
Mm-hmm.
Who was one of the most famous singers and dancers of the jazz age.
If you find clips of her on YouTube or someplace, you will be blown away. Josephine Baker was an amazing person and talent.
And this is one of those shows that the actress playing her, Tamisha Harris, developed the show. I think it's going to be amazing.
And it's a one-night-only gig,
and it's
right?
A one-night-only gig, like many things at Faulkner. So, Piano Battle,
Josephine.
Baker.
You can't do them both.
You can't do them both. One is at 7. Josephine is at 7:30. Good luck with that. Or you can go see the Royale at Theater Squared. I cannot make this decision for you. I can only tell you there's a decision to be made here.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
Walton Arts Center's 10x10 Art Series presents Ballet Memphis Contemporary Times 3, February 6th at 7 p.m. Inspired by Memphis's musical and literary heritage, the performance will include 3 original works by contemporary choreographers. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets. Theater Squared welcomes The Royale, a knockout award-winning new play told in a boxing ring over 6 rounds. It's an adrenaline rush inspired by the true story of Jack Johnson, who overcame all odds to become heavyweight champion of the world. Performances Tuesday through Sunday, now through February 16th. 777-7477 or theater2.org for tickets.
The Arkansas women's basketball team back in the winning column after yesterday's 79-57 win over Florida in Bud Walton Arena. Razorbacks now 16-4 overall, 4-3 in the SEC. Next, Arkansas travels to Tuscaloosa for a Thursday night game against Alabama. The Arkansas men also celebrating a weekend victory, defeating non-conference opponent TCU by 8 Saturday afternoon in Fayetteville. Arkansas returns to SEC action with a Wednesday night game against South Carolina in Bud Walton. Both of the University of Arkansas Fort Smith teams also posted wins Saturday. Men defeated Midwestern State by 4, the women by 20. Both UAFS teams have the week off until hosting Oklahoma Christian for a Saturday doubleheader at the Stubblefield Center beginning at 2. And the John Brown University men's basketball team winning streak at 6 after Saturday's win at Oklahoma Panhandle State. JBU remains ranked 10th in the nation in the NAIA polls. The JBU women also won Saturday. Both JBU squads play at home Thursday night against Mid-America Christian. Those games begin at 6.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
Dream Girl, take 5.
Dream Girl, Dream Girl, I love the song. Dream Girl, love is so, oh, it's you, you dear that I adore.
The story of Jesse Belvin is shrouded in some uncertainty, from his alleged hometown of Texarkana to his 1960 car crash death in southwest Arkansas. More certain is Belvin's status as a prime mover behind 1950s West Coast doo-wop. That music influenced everyone from the Beach Boys to Frank Zappa to pioneers in reggae music and beyond. But Belvin was said to be cavalier about songwriting credit and would sell his songs for immediate cash to others, who would then reap the long-term publishing. This makes tracking Belvin's influence and career still more difficult. Whatever events may have conspired to make him obscure, it's ironic for Jesse Belvin to be so forgotten today. He was once thought to be the next big crossover crooner in the mold of Nat King Cole. Late 1950s RCA Records promo materials even called him the Black Elvis.
Lord knows I felt like a king. Other girls didn't mean a doggone thing.
Jesse Lorenzo Belvin was born in 1933 in Texarkana. Or maybe it was San Antonio, Texas in 1932. His first mark in popular music was in 1950 as a part of the vocal quartet Three Dots and a Dash, backing R&B saxophonist Big J. McNeely on a single. But Belvin soon came into his own.
Someone really loves you. Guess who? Oh, guess who? Someone really cares. Guess who?
Like so many vocalists in doo-wop and rhythm and blues, Jesse Belvin got his start singing in church. And like another contemporary, Sam Cooke, Belvin was the whole package. A handsome singer, writer, and arranger, so talented and prolific, he lifted other artists with his creativity. Some of Belvin's best-known songs are by others, like Earth Angel by the Penguins. His first hit, Dream Girl, heard earlier, was listed as by Jesse and Marvin. Even his biggest solo hits, like Goodnight My Love and Guess Who, heard here as interpreted by Dean Martin, have been adopted by many others. Belvin sang with many a vocal group on small West Coast record labels like Cash and Hollywood, often under a pseudonym since he was under contract. In fact, Belvin recorded so prolifically for so many different groups, his full impact on doo-wop and beyond can likely never be calculated. You can hear Belvin singing with the Sheiks, the Californians, the Shields, the Clicks, and countless others. Sometimes the songs went nowhere. Sometimes, like You Cheated by the Shields, they went top 10. The bulk of Jesse Belvin's work done under his own name was for two larger independent labels in Los Angeles, California, Specialty and Modern. Whoa, 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 whoa. In 1956, Jesse Belvin again hit pay dirt when the ballad Goodnight My Love became an R&B hit. The song was adopted as closing theme music of programs by both Alan Freed and Dick Clark. By the late 1950s, Belvin's talent was recognized enough that he signed with major label RCA Victor. Elvis Presley had recently signed there also, and the company's PR team began a campaign branding Belvin as the Black Elvis. Belvin's sound had matured through the 1950s. Already conversant in doo-wop and R&B, Belvin began trending towards standards, ballads, and pop during this time, and the move paid off. Soon, Belvin had his first top 40 hit, 1959's Guess Who. With a major label solo deal, his first solo top 10 hit, and a big tour set for 1960, The new decade must have seemed full of promise for Jesse Belvin. But instead, Belvin's life ended on a highway in Hempstead County near Hope on February 6th, 1960. Decades later, his music is as big as ever, even as Jesse Belvin's influence continues to reveal itself. Here in its entirety is Jesse Belvin with his hit, "Good Night, My Love," from 1956.
Good night, my love. Pleasant dreams and sleep tight, my love. May tomorrow be sunny and bright and bring you closer to me.
Jesse Belvin, said to be of Texarkana, who died in Hempstead County in 1960 with his hit "Good Night, My Love" from 1956. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs, since 1998.
Tomorrow on Ozarks, our militant grammarian returns with a conversation all about sleep and words and phrases surrounding our slumber. Like sleep tight.
In earlier times, people usually slept on mattresses supported by ropes that crossed over each other. So they're lifted off the floor.
Is that to stay away from vermin or
probably,
mud
yeah,
or something?
I'm thinking. If these ropes were left loose, they would cause the bed to be very uncomfortable.
The Militant Grammarian and Sleep on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large. We expect that tomorrow's edition of our show will also begin at 11, an hour earlier than usual as we move for NPR's live coverage of the impeachment trial in the United States Senate. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and the Buffalo National River. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Contributors to this Monday show included Antoinette Grajeda. Antoinette also attended Friday's opening of the Arkansas State Police headquarters in Lowell, and she brought us sound and information from that event. Also contributing today, Jacqueline Froelich. Timothy Dennis mastered our show inside the Harold and Blanchcock News Studio. The Community Spotlight is produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio. Don't forget, you can hear the Community Spotlight every weekday morning at 6:30 and 8:30. On 91.3 KUAF Inside Morning Edition. Thank you, as always, to Becca Martin Brown, the features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, for her Monday help today, and Stephen Cook for his contribution with Arkansongs. You can find out more about our show, as well as listen to full editions of the show and individual stories and interviews at ozarksatlarge.com. We're available as a free podcast where many podcasts can be found. You can also tell your smart speaker to play the Ozarks at Large podcast. Our theme written and performed by Daryl Sean. This is 91.3 KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Back with you tomorrow.